challenge had worked. Lombardi never criticized him in front of the team again. Starr said later, "From then on, we had a relationship that was just unbelievable. I don't think it had been that bad before, but now it just took off and went to another plane." Starr and Lombardi were an odd pair, Deep South and New York City. They looked and talked like the geographic and cultural opposites that they were, but each in his own way was shaped by his experience with military discipline, and each understood how much he needed the other. Starr hungered for Lombardi's sense of order and keen football knowledge and realized that it could make him excel. The full measure of respect that he had not yet won from his father came now instead from his coach. The good son found a father in the coach, and the coach found another son in the quarterback. Lombardi knew that if he told Starr to do something, it would get done. He didn't have to worry about where Starr was at any time. He was always literally and figuratively within safe reach, which is not something that could be said about some other key players. If Lombardi fretted that the quarterback position was too important in football, at least he now had a quarterback who was loyal in every way, who would carry out his game plans flawlessly, who opened up his brain and let Lombardi pour his knowledge in. Murray Warmath, who had worked with Lombardi on Red Blake's staff at West Point, came down from the University of Minnesota to watch the Packers and concluded that Starr was the perfect athlete to run Lombardi's huddle. "He and Vince," Warmath reflected decades later, "were hand and glove." By the time the Packers reached Los Angeles for the final game, they were alone in first place with a 7-4 record, one game ahead of the Colts, who'd lost three straight. They controlled their own fate at last. All they had to do was beat the Rams to win the Western Conference title. The Rams were out of the race and hobbling, with eight starters injured, but they'd upset the Colts the week before and enjoyed being spoilers. Bart Starr usually slept soundly the night before a game, just like Coach Lombardi, comforted by the thoroughness of his preparations, and woke up refreshed. But he found no rest on the eve of the Rams game. All night long he flailed about uneasily, playing the next day's game in his subconscious, reviewing game situations that his roommate, Gary Kanafel, had been drilling him on the night before. "It's 2nd-and-3, we're on the far side against a 5-2 defense. What do you call?" Kanafel couldn't sleep either, and shortly after dawn, the two Packers climbed out of bed like brothers, eager to scamper downstairs for Christmas. "I realized that the big day had finally arrived," Starr wrote in a diary he kept for that game. "We'd been aiming at it all week." He turned on the television and heard news of a massive mid-air collision over New York Harbor involving United Airlines and TWA jets that killed 134 people. But he was so anxious about the game that even that stunning report couldn't hold his attention. He showered and dressed without shaving. He never shaved on game day, and took the elevator down to the lobby of the Miramar Hotel. Jim Ringo and Hog Hanner were already lounging in the lobby. Starr needed time alone. He walked across the street to the oceanfront and thought about the game, trying to adjust myself. On the way back to his room, he stopped at a newsstand and bought a copy of Johnny Unitas's book. No subject interested Starr more than how to play quarterback, and Johnny U was the best. But even that seemed a bother now. The pre-game meal began at 9, and Starr picked at his food. "Everything seemed so dry," he wrote, "even with all the butter on the baked potato and toast." After breakfast, he and Kanafel went to the trainer's room to have their ankles taped. Lombardi believed in taping. Every ankle, every game. An untaped ankle, if discovered, meant a certain fine, and injuring an untaped ankle meant a Lombardi eruption. All jokes and lightness in the taping room as usual, everybody laughing and cutting up, with equipment man, Dad Brasher, and trainer, Bud Jorgensen, getting their last-minute jokes out of the way. What next? Starr returned to his room one last time, losing himself briefly in a magazine story about a seeing-eye dog. Then, out the door and down the elevator to take the team bus to the stadium. What? Everybody was already on the bus, and there was Lombardi in front, glaring at them. "That'll be $50, gentlemen." Starr thought they were 7 minutes early, but they were 8 minutes late. They'd apparently missed an announcement at breakfast that the departure time had been changed. Starr was embarrassed. "It was," he wrote in his journal, "the first time I had ever been late for anything in my life." Bart Starr, late for the bus, for the most important game of his career. This did not go unnoticed by some of the more rambunctious players on the team, who had been fined many times already by the punctual Lombardi. Jim Taylor, an ornery individualist, would usually loiter around the side of the bus until the last possible second, just to get the old man teed off a little. Some of the team playboys might be seen hustling out the hotel door, tucking in their shirts, putting on their sport coats, and clearing their pockets of extra condoms not used the night before. But never before was Bart Starr late. "Welcome to the club!" one shouted. A few giggles. Then the bus grew quiet for the ride to the stadium. It was Starr's habit to take a brief look at the field before going into the locker room to dress for the game, but he said that he didn't want to see the field this time. He and Knafel dressed quietly in their cubicle. Starr read a game program, trying to quiet the butterflies. He was struck by an open letter to the fans from Coach Bob Waterfield, asking them to help keep Rams players in Los Angeles during the off-season. Starr had been thinking about that issue a lot in recent days. The closer his relationship became with Lombardi, the more sense he thought it made for him and his wife, Cherry, to live year-round in Green Bay. That thought was broken by Lombardi's booming voice. Time for his pregame meeting with the quarterbacks. Starr and Lamar McCann and the coach went over the personnel of the Rams' defense, the offensive game plan. Starr called his own plays, but Lombardi gave him the first few to start the game. When Starr reached the field for the pregame warm-ups, his anxiety disappeared. Now he was feeling loose and easy. Max McGee, the team cut-up, made a great catch in the drills, and everybody hooted and whistled at him. Then back in the dressing room one last time, heart pounding, adrenaline flowing. Starr rinsed his face and removed his jersey to put on the shoulder pads, and took a seat in the main squad room for the players' meeting. The old guys, Hog Hanner and M. Tunnell, did most of the talking. M. says the most intelligent things before the games, Starr noted in his diary. He sizes up the situation perfectly. Only mistakes would beat us, he told the squad. The players ended their session with the Lord's Prayer. Lombardi entered the room. "I was anxious to hear him," Starr wrote. "He said 3 weeks ago they had counted us out, and now we were getting a second chance. He said he didn't have to tell us what this game meant, but warned us about keying ourselves up too much. He told us how big the Rams are, and kept reminding us that football is two things, blocking and tackling, plus running the ball. And play the game with abandon, because every time you played with abandon, you won," the coach said. "He always does an extremely fine job of getting us worked up. You could run through the wall when he lets you go. He doesn't plead. He just stands there telling us what to do in his very authoritative voice." We rushed out of the dressing room door with a shout, and I felt well prepared to play the game. The Packers threw only 11 passes all afternoon, 9 by Starr, 2 by Hornung. Yet they won the game with a spectacularly effective passing attack. Thunder and Lightning could go nowhere on the ground, gaining only 66 yards between them. But Starr completed 8 of 9 passes, including touchdown tosses of 91 yards to Boyd Dowler and 57 yards to Max McGee. And Hornung completed a 40-yard halfback option pass to McGee for another touchdown. The Rams gained nearly twice as much yardage and accumulated twice as many first downs, but after scoring the first touchdown, they were never again in the game. The final score was 35-21. The Packers had won their first conference title since 1944. In the locker room after the game, Fuzzy Thurston was a madman, grabbing people and shouting. A Hollywood contingent, including Bing Crosby's sons and Gardner McKay, came in to snap pictures and mingle with Hornung and his handsome young teammates. Starr and Knafel were relatively quiet amid the celebration. Knafel had been knocked cold in the second quarter and played the entire second half semi-conscious, without memory. He was still in a trance when Coach Lombardi came around shaking hands, and when he reached their cubicle, he said, "Great game, both of you. Forget the fine." "Thanks a lot, you son of a bitch," mumbled the dazed Knafel. The coach walked away, smiling. The team returned to Green Bay the following night, and as their charter plane rolled down the runway to the terminal, the players looked out into the frigid December blackness at an amazing scene. There were fans everywhere, roaring swells behind the cyclone fences at Austin's Straubel Airport. 11,000 Packerbackers who'd been waiting for hours, chanting and screaming for their team, holding signs that read, 8-4, just one more, and "It's a cinch with Vince." With the team riding in 2 buses behind a police escort, and a mile-long line of cars behind the buses, a joyous caravan snaked through town from the airport, passing a fireworks display at City Stadium and crossing the Fox River to the Hotel Northland. At the homecoming ceremony, the players and coaches were given engraved wallets, each with a $50 bill. Lombardi was gracious in his comments, praising his players, his assistant coaches, the wonderful fans of Green Bay, and the scout with the oversized heart who died too soon. A great part of this team is due to Jack Vanisi, who no longer is with us, he said. But nothing Lombardi said could diminish his own stature. He'd earned a new nickname during the triumphant swing through the West. In restoring the Packers to their old glory, he was becoming not just a football coach, but the stuff of myth, a transcendent figure. St. Vincent? No, more than that. Green Bay was an area with a bishop and a vicar general, 8 monsignors, 50 priests, and 350 religious sisters. But there was only one Lombardi. "There he is," people screamed, "the Pope! Look at the Pope!" The odds makers favored Green Bay by 2 points in the title game against the Eastern winners, the Philadelphia Eagles, but both teams were a surprise to be there. They'd followed the same fast track, zooming from last to first in their conferences in 2 years. The Eagles had some talented young players, including running backs Tim Brown and Ted Dean, backup quarterback Sonny Jurgensen, receiver Tommy McDonald, and linebacker Maxie Bawn. But for the most part, their championship season was seen as a curtain call for 3 grand old pros. Their coach, Buck Shaw, their quarterback, the fiery Norm Van Brocklin, and their indestructible throwback, Chuck Bednarik, who was playing not only his normal center position, but also filling in for an injured linebacker. Concrete Charlie was the last real 60-minute man in the league. The championship matchup in that sense contrasted 2 cultures. The Eagles were the old way, with gunslinging quarterbacks and 2-way players, all grit and improvisation. The Packers were Lombardi's vision of the new professionals, methodical and relentless. They were also still a curiosity for much of the country. From Los Angeles to New York, from Green Bay to Dallas, pro football fans are wondering, How did Vince Lombardi do it? How did a 47-year-old Brooklynite become a hero to every native of a small Midwestern city by leading the Green Bay Packers into next Monday's championship game with the Eagles? Frank Dolson, writing in the Philadelphia Inquirer, posed that question in his December 22nd column and found one man, Colonel Red Blake, who knew the answer. Blake was retired from football by then. He'd left the Army job 2 years earlier to work for a defense contractor, but he was thoroughly enjoying the success of his former assistant. Surprised? Blake responded when Dolson asked him about Lombardi's rise to the top of the coaching profession. I was anything but surprised. The only thing that puzzled Blake was that it had taken so long for others to appreciate the qualities in Lombardi that he'd seen during their time together at West Point. Lombardi was a superior individual all the way around, he told Dolson. Loyal, decent, inspiring, someone who believes in winning and never rationalizes a defeat, and hates to lose whether it's pinochle or cribbage or football, though he learns from every loss. Style rather than substance, Blake said, allowed coaches of inferior character and talent to rise more quickly than Lombardi. He doesn't look like a man of great intellect, but what do appearances mean? I deal with a lot of scientists today. You ought to see how little some of them look the part. Some fellas have that Madison Avenue smoothness. They get a coaching job, and then they rattle around. Vince isn't that type of man. Oh, he has an extrovert side to him. He can be a dynamo when he has to be. But like a lot of men with ability, he's a man of moods. Lombardi was in a generous mood in the days before the championship game. The weather in Green Bay plunged toward zero on Friday, so the coach limited outdoor practice to just 10 minutes of loosening up. When he heard that Bob Skoronski's in-laws lived near Philadelphia, he invited the offensive tackle to bring his wife and 3 young sons along on the flight east. The Packers left Green Bay on Christmas Eve, taking a 2.5-hour charter flight captained by Don Smith, a former Green Bay resident. Lombardi had 1,000 little superstitions, and Smith was one of them, his good luck pilot. As the delegation deplaned, an AP photographer captured Skoronski, loaded down with 3 kids, shouting for help, and Lombardi grinning broadly as he scooped 1-year-old Steve Skoronski into his arms. "The gang's all here," read the caption. Here was Lombardi, portrayed as the gregarious family man. Vincent and Susan could be excused for doing a double take when they saw the picture. He always seemed so loving with other people's kids. Lombardi and his troops arrived at their hotel at 5 that afternoon, greeted in the lobby by a band playing On Wisconsin, followed by Hornung's favorite, the Notre Dame Victory March. It snowed in Philadelphia that night, and the Packers woke up to a white Christmas. The television sports industry hadn't yet cracked the sacrosanct Christmas barrier, so the championship game was held not on Sunday, but Monday, December 26th. And since the venue was venerable Franklin Field, which had no lights, the starting time was set at noon to assure that the final quarter wouldn't be played in the winter gloaming. Monday noon was not exactly television prime time, but even placing the game that close to Christmas seemed excessive to many people, a sign of commercialism run amok. As the 1960s began, the writing press was still struggling with the new way, lamenting the fact that major sporting events were not just for the scribes in the press box and fans in the stands. The sense of order, of propriety, has been offended, wrote New York columnist Jimmy Powers. How far can commercials go? But with time, we grow accustomed to a lot of things. It matters little now how many fans attend an event in person. Sports slowly are being beamed for the mass TV audience, the millions who sit comfortably at home. In effect, today's game between the Packers and Eagles is the World Series of football. It's reasonable to state that for every person who sits shivering in the stands to watch it in person, hundreds will be at home, absorbing statistics and through the magic of powerful lenses, actually seeing more of the intricate play. The point clangs with absurd obviousness now, but it was fresh enough to seem worth making then, though in truth, 1960 was not the best year for the NFL on television. This was through no fault of the new commissioner, Alvin Ray Pete Rozelle, the young publicity wizard who'd made the Los Angeles Rams a glittering West Coast enterprise. Rozelle had revolutionary plans for promoting and selling his league on television, but it required what he called a unity of purpose among the set of cantankerous owners. He had to persuade them that they could have more power and get richer by negotiating collectively and pooling their resources rather than operating each franchise like an individual business. They were in the process of reaching that unity in 1960, pushed along, to be sure, by the upstart American Football League, which had a league-wide contract with ABC. But they were not quite there yet. While 10 teams were broadcast on CBS, the Browns were under contract with the Independent Sports Network in Cleveland, and the Baltimore Colts and Pittsburgh Steelers were broadcast on NBC, which also had rights to the championship game. The ratings drop in 1960 to 10.6 from 12.5 the previous year was a one-year oddity, a result of the novelty of the AFL, and the fact that teams in the NFL's three largest markets, New York, Chicago, and Los Angeles, had mediocre seasons. There were, in any case, enough people at Franklin Field that Monday noon to fill the stadium, 67,325, the second largest crowd in pro playoff history. And Powers need not have worried about their comfort. There was no shivering. The temperature soared to the upper 40s, leaving the playing field in peculiar condition, with a thin layer of soggy grass over rock-hard earth in patches heated by the sun, but still icy spots in the shadows. From the opening play, when Wild Bill Quinlan intercepted a Van Brocklin lateral pass on the Eagles' 14-yard line, the Packers seemed relentless, but somehow kept coming up short. They ran Taylor, Hornung, Taylor, Taylor on the first four plays, but they couldn't grind out 10 yards, and the Eagles took over on downs. That was the first of two instances in the game when Lombardi chose to run on fourth down deep in Eagles territory and failed, instead of taking the easy 3 points by kicking a field goal. When it happened the second time, during the opening drive of the third quarter, the Eagles were leading 10-6, even though the Packers had been controlling the ball and seemed to be dominating the line of scrimmage. The only Philadelphia touchdown to that point came when Hank Greminger slipped on the ice and Tommy McDonald scooted by him to make a 37-yard touchdown catch. It took a freelance scramble by Max McGee late in the third quarter to bring Green Bay back. Hornung was out of the game by then, a nerve in his left shoulder pinched from a ferocious hit by Tom Brookshire that would haunt him for the rest of his career. Starr had misfired on three consecutive passes, high to McGee, low to Taylor, high to Dowler, and McGee dropped back to punt from his 19-yard line. As he waited for the long snap, two thoughts ran through his mind. First were the words that Coach Lombardi had barked at him when he took over as coach. "McGee, you're going to be my punter. You're not going to run the football on fourth down." Second was the vision in front of him. Wide open. "I catch this friggin' ball, and all my instincts would not let me kick it," McGee recalled later. "I see these guys going back to set up their return. Normally they keep one guy to make sure you kick it. They didn't. I could see the first down." Ignoring Lombardi's warning, the old Chilean halfback tucked the ball in and loped 35 yards downfield, taking the ball into Eagles territory. Seven plays later, he caught a 7-yard touchdown pass from Starr to put the Packers ahead. When he trotted off the field after the extra point, even though his derring-do had given the Packers a 13-10 lead, he found a spot on the sidelines as far away from the coach as he could get. Lombardi had little time to search out McGee. His eyes swung back to the field with alarm as Ted Dean, Philadelphia's swift halfback, was busting loose and sprinting upfield, returning the kickoff 57 yards, immediately putting the Eagles back in scoring position. 8 plays later, Dean carried the ball on a sweep play around left end and scored from the 5. With the extra point, Philadelphia led 17-13. Time was running out. After an exchange of punts, the Packers took over for the last time with 1:20 left in the game. Bart Starr trotted out to the huddle. He'd struggled all day. But now, as his teammates looked over at him, they noticed that he seemed eerily calm. There were 63 yards to the goal line, but every man in the huddle believed that they would get there. Starr 5 yards to Taylor. Starr 4 yards to Tom Moore, Hornung's replacement. Taylor on the Green Bay sweep for 9 more, out of bounds just across the midfield stripe. Starr to Knaffel for 17. Incomplete to Dowler. Starr to Knaffel for 8 more. The Packers are now at the Eagles 22. Chuck Bednarik sits on Knaffel after the catch, letting precious seconds tick off the clock. Time for only 1 more play. Red Smith, of the New York Herald Tribune, Green Bay-born, and Notre Dame-bred, a Lombardi man since Vince's West Point days, was watching from the press box. For 59 minutes plus, he wrote, "The Philadelphia Eagles and Green Bay Packers, 1958 dogs of the National Football League, had heaved and hauled and grappled and threshed across the squashy turf for $2,011.41 per hessian, the difference between winning and losing the title of world's toughest mercenaries." From the Philadelphia 22-yard line, Bart Starr passed to Jim Taylor. That wonderful runner ducked his head like a charging bull, bolted like an enraged beer truck into Philadelphia's congested secondary, twisted, staggered, bucked, and wrestled one step at a time. Photographer Robert Reiger was watching the same scene from a more intimate angle. "I was the only camera in the end zone and wanted a picture of Taylor coming right at me for the touchdown," Reiger said. "Come to Papa, and I'll give you the whole town of Green Bay." The play started, and Starr shot the fullback a little nickel pass on the left side. He took it and cut back over center and had one man to beat, a rookie in a spanking clean uniform who'd just been sent in, Bobby Jackson. And the kid made the stop. Bednarik came over and there was a big pile-up, but had Taylor gotten by Jackson, Green Bay would have won, and I would have had the picture. The image that lingers is not the unheralded Bobby Jackson making the initial stop, but Bednarik pounding over to the scrum and sitting on Taylor as time ran out. "I was on top of him and I stayed there," Bednarik recalled. "You're darn right I was watching the clock. I made up my mind I was going to lay on him until it was over." That is known as stalling for time. Taylor remained sprawled on the ground for a half minute after the gun had sounded. Philadelphia police rushed across the thawing field, black buttons agleam on blue heroic abdomens, as Red Smith described them, in a vain effort to keep fans from tearing down the goalposts. Bednarik, a mess of mud and sweat, stood near the fallen Taylor. "Get up," he said. "This goddamn game is over." Then he looked up to the roaring stands, lifted his gnarled fists high above his head in victory, and unloosed a blood-curdling shout of triumph. As Taylor made his way to his feet, the injured Hornung, shrouded in a warm-up cape, walked out to console him. Thunder and lightning, and old concrete Charlie Bednarik stepped between them and embraced each of his young competitors and said they had a hell of a football team and would be back in the championship the next year. Robert Reiger never got the photograph of Taylor scoring the phantom winning touchdown, but he was nearby when this scene took place and shot a picture from behind the three athletes, exhausted and limping off the battlefield, arm in arm, that evoked emotions far deeper than winning or losing. Dominik Olenichik, president of the board of directors, wiped tears from his eyes as he entered the losing locker room after the game, but there were no tears among the players and coaches. To them, this was not a last fleeting chance, but a first chance. The sense was that they didn't lose, they just ran out of time. Lombardi said as much to the press. If we could have added a couple of more seconds at the end of each half, we would have been all right, he said. McGee chuckled to himself when he overheard his coach say that he was neither surprised nor bothered by Max's run off the fake punt. With veterans like McGee, we give them the option, Lombardi said. Right, McGee thought to himself. And if I hadn't made the first down, it would have been my last option. With the press out of the room, Lombardi gathered his players around him and said there was a revelation in this loss. Perhaps you didn't realize that you could have won this game, he said in a quiet, deliberate voice. But I think there's no doubt in your minds now, and that's why you will win it all next year. This will never happen again. You will never lose another championship. That night, Lombardi took his family and a group of friends and team officials to dinner in downtown Philadelphia. At one point, he was sitting alone with Ray Scott, the voice of the Packers, and they replayed the game one last time. He was proud of his men, Lombardi said. They had given every ounce of effort, but that was more than he could say for himself. He'd cost the team 6 points, the difference between winning and losing, by not going for easy field goals. Coach, he said to Scott, using his all-purpose nickname, which he applied equally to people he admired and others whose name he'd forgotten. I learned my lesson today. When you get down there, come out with something. I lost the game, not my players. That was my fault. An important aspect of the mythology of Vince Lombardi is that his rise took place in Green Bay, not New York. For a New Yorker to succeed in New York is a routine story. Even though it's an oft-told tale, there's a certain romance to someone coming from the provinces and making it in New York. But for the opposite to happen, for a New Yorker to leave the big city and head out to the middle of nowhere to become famous, that's an adventure story with something in it for everyone. New York, his hometown, the place where myths were conceived and written and broadcast and spread, was rooting for Lombardi as a favorite son, and the rest of the country found something magical and inspiring in the emergence of Little Green Bay, the David among the Goliaths of professional football. As dissimilar as they were, this coach and town seemed the perfect combination. Just as Green Bay couldn't have succeeded without Lombardi, Lombardi wouldn't have become what he became without Green Bay. It very nearly didn't happen that way. The symbiosis of Lombardi and Green Bay almost ended before it had fully developed. At the end of the 1959 season, Jim Lee Howell had walked into Wellington Mara's office and announced that he was burned out. The thrill of winning, Howell said, no longer compensated for the deep anxiety he took from losing. He would coach the 1960 season, but that would be his last. Howell's surprise burnout didn't come at the best time for the Maras. Not only had they let Lombardi go to Green Bay a year earlier, but they had just lost Tom Landry to the expansion team in Dallas. The brains in the New York Coaching Brain Trust were employed elsewhere. Would Lombardi come back? The Maras had reason to believe that he would. When they had released him from the final year of his contract back in January 1959 to go out to Green Bay, it was with the understanding that he would have first chance at the Giants' coaching job should a vacancy ever occur. As soon as Howell told the Maras of his plans, they contacted Olenichik in Green Bay and secured secret permission from him to talk to Lombardi about the Giants' job. Lombardi met with the Maras during his winter trip to New York at the end of the 1959 season, when he was being anointed as Coach of the Year, and expressed an interest in returning. However, as a Giants document on the issue later stated, both parties recognized his obligations in Green Bay, and it was agreed that the matter would be tabled until the completion of the 1960 NFL season. The Green Bay press spent the season concentrating on the stunning improvement of the Packers on the field, mostly trying to ignore rumors about Lombardi's departure. But sports writers in New York devoted much of their energy to speculating about his return. It seemed that all of New York wanted Vinny back. Ed Sullivan, the television host, who golfed at Westchester Country Club with Giants executives, was constantly promoting Lombardi for the job, sending clips about him to members of the New York press corps who were eager to recount his glory and lay out the arguments as to why he should leave Green Bay. Yes, he was hailed as the Pope in Green Bay and had performed a miracle there, but so what? They asked in print. In his columns from Green Bay, Red Smith never failed to write that Lombardi was pacing the wrong sidelines. Lombardi has relished his success in Green Bay, has enjoyed being his own boss even though the double job makes heavy demands on his time, Smith wrote in a column after Thanksgiving, just before the season-changing Bears game. But he doesn't try to hide his homesickness. They love Vincent in Green Bay. They would love him in New York. Another Lombardi booster was Arthur Daly of the New York Times, a Fordham graduate and longtime Lombardi friend, not to be confused with Art Daly of the Green Bay Press Gazette. Lombardi, he wrote in early December, was a New Yorker at heart, and always the Giants' boy. The venerable Stanley Woodward, who'd known Lombardi since they shared a cabin together at Red Blake's Bull Pond, pounded out the same theme. Vincenzo, as everyone knows, has about as much business being out in Green Bay as Mayor Robert Wagner. He's strictly New York, New Jersey, and his playing coaching career until he heard the jingle of Wisconsin shekels was on the line of Fordham St. Cecilia's West Point New York Giants. He was Colonel Earl H. Blake's Tower of Pisa, and the Giants have never attained the class they showed when he ran the offense. It's your move, Jack Mara. These Eastern writers watched with equal parts admiration and fear as Lombardi's Packers swept through the end of the season and headed toward Philadelphia for the championship. With every win, the Times' Daily wrote, it appeared that Lombardi was tightening the chains anchoring him to Green Bay. It's clear that Lombardi was confiding in his pals in the New York press corps and that their ambivalence reflected his own. Should he stay or leave? Marie had never fully adjusted to the small-town life and would gladly move back to New Jersey. Lombardi's attachment to the Packers' board of directors could not match the personal bond he felt toward the Maras. Daly of the Times was right. Vince loved New York. During one of his trips back to Manhattan, as he was crossing Fifth Avenue in Midtown, he looked up at the skyscrapers and announced, "This is my town." New York was where he always thought he would coach, if not at Fordham, then with the Giants. But there were compelling reasons to stay. He wielded more power in Green Bay than he could ever hope to have with the Giants. Wellington and Jack Mara admired him, but they were not willing to cede all authority. As much as he enjoyed many of the players he'd coached as a Giants assistant, he felt equally close to the Packers. And in terms of talent, they were younger and better. The people he admired most in the league, including George Halas of the rival Bears, urged him to remain in Green Bay. Part of the Halas argument, which was also made by Paul Brown and to a lesser extent by Commissioner Roselle, was that Lombardi had in essence saved the Green Bay franchise, and that his leaving would endanger it again. Even more important to Halas was the fear that if Lombardi voided his contract in Green Bay and left for New York, it would weaken the NFL in its struggle with the AFL. If coaches could break their contracts, how could the league use moral pressure to keep players from doing the same? With these factors to consider, Lombardi vacillated, as he had during most of his important career decisions. At times during that fall and winter, he told friends that he could persuade the Packers to release him from his contract. At other times, he said that he wouldn't do it. Olenichik made it clear that he did not want Lombardi to go. "I'd just as soon lose both legs as lose Lombardi," he said before the Eagles game. "But I know one thing. He's a man of integrity." There were reports later that the Packers' board refused to release Lombardi. They might have in the end, but it was never put to a final test. He met with Wellington Mara in Philadelphia before the championship game and told Mara that he had decided to stay in Green Bay. He said that he had to fulfill his obligations there, Mara said later. And he also knew that he had a darn good team coming back. He told me that. When reporters broached the subject after the game, Lombardi gave them an answer of sorts. "Let's have no more of that talk," he barked. 6 weeks after Jack Vannesi died, his wife suffered another heartbreak. The baby that she'd been carrying was delivered stillborn on January 4, 1961. A few weeks later, Lombardi called and asked Jackie to join him and Marie for dinner at the country club. Marie, who'd suffered through two childbirth tragedies of her own, tried to console Jackie, and the three friends talked about football and children and old times through dinner, until finally Lombardi leaned across the table and lowered his voice to a rough whisper. "I have to ask you this, or I will get no peace," he said. "Do you think I was at all the cause of Jack's death?" Jackie Vannesi thought about how her husband would attempt to conceal the pain shooting down his left arm, how he would eat entire lemon meringue pies when she wasn't looking, how she tried to change his diet to give him vegetables, but he just kept gobbling up more desserts despite his heart condition, and worked more, 18-hour days and nights, wanting to excel, to win, to find the best boys out there, agreeing with what Vince was doing, first class all the way, nothing second-rate or half-hearted, the full measure of commitment, until that Sunday after Thanksgiving when he slumped dead on the bathroom floor at age 33, before he could see all the great players he'd scouted perform in their first championship game. "No," she said to Lombardi. "You didn't kill him, of course not. Nobody could do that to Jack but Jack." Chapter 15. Golden. "Time let me play and be golden in the mercy of his means." Dylan Thomas, Fern Hill. He struggled in obscurity for 20 years, and then fame arrived, and it came to him in a rush. He'd been in Green Bay for only 2 seasons. His Packers had won 15 games and lost 10. He'd captured a conference crown, but not a league championship. His achievements as a professional football coach were solid but not singular, not in the same class as those of George Halas, the Papa Bear who'd been running things in Chicago since the league's creation 40 years earlier, or Paul Brown, who had won an average of 10 games a year over 14 seasons with his Cleveland Browns, or even Weeb Eubank, who'd led the Baltimore Colts to consecutive championships at the end of the 50s. Yet by the first few months of 1961, Vince Lombardi was a transcendent figure in football, worshipped as the Pope in Green Bay, coveted by other teams, held up by national sports writers as the model of leadership. He was so hot that John F. Kennedy, the new president, who had first met him on the steps of St. Willibrord during the 1960 Wisconsin primary, talked about him admiringly, and wrote notes to him, and invited him to the inauguration in Washington. Missed it. League meetings to attend. And Robert F. Kennedy, the Attorney General, made plans to see the Packers the next time they came east. What was it about Lombardi that set him apart? It couldn't have been style over substance in any conventional sense. He was innately shy, sometimes painfully so, according to Marie. He had to screw up his courage every day to be a public figure. The witty chatter and glad-handing didn't come naturally to him. He was literal, not subtle. If you invited him to a 6:30 cocktail party, peer out the window at 6:25 and you would see him pulling up in his Pontiac, ignoring Marie's plea that they drive around the block a few times to avoid being the first guests ringing the doorbell. Straight ahead with Vince. He did not fake or seduce or charm his way into celebrity. Nothing flashy about his looks. Squat and sturdy build, gap-tooth smile, broad and fleshy nose, thick-lens glasses, short wavy dark hair, salted with whitish-gray, always fresh from the barber's chair. In dress, he was indistinguishable from the State Farm agent on Monroe Street, or the cheese broker over at the Bellin Building, or the floor manager at H.C. Prangy's department store. Invariably neat, with his big class ring and wristwatch and tie clasp, and button-down, short-sleeved white shirt. The furthest thing from Kennedy cool. He wore hats and galoshes and rain slickers made of translucent plastic, and played golf and gin rummy, and cried and screamed and smoked and sweated, and watched Tom and Jerry cartoons, and laughed so hard that tears squirted out of his eyes like windshield wiper spray. He fell asleep in the recliner chair in his den, and snored away until supper. No way around it. Lombardi was a square. And yet look again, and something else emerges. Here he is, on the Wednesday evening of April 5th, 1961, making his way through the banquet hall of Tappan's Restaurant at the corner of Ocean and Voorhees in Sheepshead Bay, guest of honor at a testimonial dinner dance sponsored by his hometown Board of Trade. Chris Schenkel, the network sportscaster, has just introduced him. Sell-out crowd, the place buzzing. Frank Gifford is there, and the Maras, and Father Tim, and Harry, and Maddie, and all the Izzos. Uncle Pete and Uncle Frank, in black tie and tails, lead him up to the front, this way, past the Kiwanis Club table, and the Knights of Columbus table, band playing the Fordham Ram fight song, Lombardi walking with his left fist clenched in triumph, a white carnation shining in the lapel of his dark gray suit, the suggestion of a smile creasing his face. His confirmation day smile, 4 decades later. These are his people, yes, and he is their favorite son, former altar boy at St. Mark's, grandson of Tony the Barber. His homecoming harks back to a Sheepshead Bay that's fading from view. Like Brooklyn, stores closing, families moving out to Jersey and Staten Island, Dodgers gone to the California sun. Like any aging small town now, a departure place, not a destination. As the program for the evening states, since we cannot root for a home team, we root for home talent. We are grateful, Vince. Your deeds have done us proud. But if there is unavoidably a touch of sentimentalism to the occasion, there is more to Lombardi as he strides through the room. Square and awkward he might be, yet he overpowers people with his will as he walks by. Character is the will in action, his Fordham tutors used to say, and here it is, embodied, magnetism of the will, asserting that life isn't merely fleeting luck or chance, that discipline and persistence can prevail, even if it takes 20 years. And as he presses forward, the crowd seems certain that he knows the way, the right way, that even if he hasn't won everything he will, that he's beyond Sheepshead Bay and Green Bay, and the applause wells up in the hall, deafening now, and it lifts them out of their seats as he goes by, and they want to follow him. It was a snap to draw the organizational chart of the Green Bay Packers then, Vince Lombardi in a box at the top, alone. Everyone else below him at about the same level. If he was the Pope, there was no College of Cardinals. Assistant coaches, ticket office clerks, players, members of the executive committee, they were all equally afraid of him. As one assistant later explained, it became a reciprocal thing. Don't tell on me and I won't tell on you. Sooner or later, you knew you were going to screw up in a way he wouldn't like if he found out. That bonded everyone together. When Dominik Olenichik confided that he would rather have his legs amputated than lose Lombardi, the sentiment was one-sided. No other club had given a coach as much authority as we gave Vince, the Packers president said. Lombardi seized the opportunity and wanted as little to do with the executive committee as possible. He led a few on the plane with us, but they were more like the players, according to Bob Skoronski. If we lost, they wanted to sit in the back with us. During the off-season, grateful that Lombardi hadn't fled to New York, Ole and his executive committee rewarded him with a new 5-year contract, tearing up his original pact, which still had 3 years to run. His salary wasn't revealed at the time, but records indicate the raise pushed it above $50,000. The new contract only strengthened his iron rule. Even his closest pals on the committee, Tony, the Grey Ghost, Canadeo, and Dick Borgannon, understood the imbalance in the relationship. "If you don't agree with me, I'll take away your vote," Lombardi once said to them. It was a joke, but he meant it. He expected a rubber stamp from the board of directors. At league meetings, he and attorney Fred Trowbridge did most of the talking for the club, with one notable exception. At sessions limited to owners, Olenichik stayed in the room, and Vince was asked to leave. It always bothered the hell out of him to face this reminder that he was not complete master of his universe. Lombardi was not the sort of boss who slipped into the office unnoticed. People sensed him coming before he arrived, like a meteorological phenomenon, a weather front rolling into Green Bay from Saskatchewan. His mood, high pressure or low, was going to define their day. If he smiled as he hung his camel's hair coat on the rack near the Crook Street entrance and began with a pleasant "Good morning, Ruth," to Ruth McCloskey, the staff responded in kind with great relief. If he tramped in with a scowl, they tried to steer clear of him until the storm passed. The storm, in most cases, featured a sudden tirade, often directed at Tom Miller, the mild-mannered publicist. If Lombardi strolled over to the duplicating machine and told one of his corny jokes and laughed loudly, they all laughed with him. Although he seemed to have a one-track mind, the track was long and wide. Anything to do with his football operation. Lorraine Keck had been working at H.C. Prangy's that year when she was told that the Packers needed a girl to help with secretarial duties. She walked over to the team's downtown office, and there was Lombardi, waiting to ask her how fast she typed and whether she could take shorthand. Keck quickly learned Lombardi's philosophy of perfecting the little things, a trait that he'd acquired from Colonel Blake at West Point. When he spoke into the dictaphone, he meticulously included all punctuation. After letters were typed, they went back to him so that he could double-check the spelling. He demanded precision. Letters answered quickly, documents neatly filed, no unfinished tasks lingering at the end of the day. The office hours were 9 to 5, but anyone arriving at 9 was considered 15 minutes late, the same Lombardi standard time that his players had encountered. One morning, before leaving for an off-season vacation with Marie, he called the staff into his office. "While I'm gone, I don't want any slovenly work around here. Do what you're supposed to do," he said. A few days later, he called from the Caribbean to check on them. One young receptionist was scared to death of Lombardi. Whenever she got near him, her hands shook uncontrollably. She couldn't speak when she saw him coming. At night, she dreamed about him, all nightmares. Finally, after a few weeks of torment, she went to Ruth McCloskey and said she had to quit. For the most part, though, Lombardi knew when to pull back. After lecturing McCloskey one morning on the proper way to list assets and liabilities, a subject she knew more about than he did, he approached her at the mail counter later and poked her on the arm. "Still mad at me?" he asked, breaking into a grin. She laughed and said no. There were other saving graces that counterbalanced his autocratic bearing. He was a softy at heart, according to Keck, and wouldn't hesitate to send people home to attend to sick relatives. Though it was impossible not to hear him swearing in the film room, he was courteous around the women. McCloskey approached his desk once when he was screaming into his phone at a league official, "What the hell is going on, goddammit?" until he saw his secretary, covered the receiver, turned to her and said, "Excuse me, Ruth." Keck discovered that the more outspoken she was around Lombardi, the more he seemed to enjoy it, as long as she did her work. "I was dumb enough and green enough that if I thought something was not right, I would tell him. He got so little of that pushing back. Everyone was, 'Yes, sir, yes, sir.' He liked a little, 'No, sir.'" That was true, only when it served his purposes. Lombardi was decidedly less open to argument when it came time to negotiate new contracts with his players, and he would thwart their efforts by any means necessary. The players' union was not yet a bargaining force. There were no agents to haggle with, and players had little freedom or security. Along with these advantages, Lombardi brought to the negotiations the skills of a psychologist. He knew just when to stroke and when to intimidate. When Bob Skowronski began making a case for a raise, Lombardi pulled a piece of paper from his drawer and said, "You had a pretty good year, but against the Rams we had a 3rd-and-1. And we ran a 36, and you didn't get the job done, did you, Bob?" As Skowronski tried to counter by citing a crucial block he'd made against San Francisco, Lombardi rose from his chair, walked around the desk, and affectionately rubbed his tackle's crew-cut scalp. The tactic silenced Skowronski and settled the debate. A preemptive strike that compelled Skowronski the following year to open by saying, "Coach, I want you to sit in that chair and not come over and touch me during these negotiations." Gary Knafel was so certain that he would be tongue-tied that he came in with a typed sheet of accomplishments. As Knafel later recounted, "I walked in, and he acted like he was on the phone and left me just standing there. I was just perspiring. He looked at me and said, 'Sit down.' I sat down. I said, 'Coach, I have this—' He stopped me and said, 'Just a minute.' He had to make another call. I knew I was dead already. He hung up and said, 'Yes?' And I said, 'Please read this.' It listed my passes caught to passes thrown, blocking awards, grasping anything I could. He didn't look at it a second and a half and then threw it back to me, and with that big finger he had pointed clear across the table at me and said, 'Gary, all you played was offense. You were not on the kickoff team. You were not on the punt return team. All you played was offense.' He said he would give me 2,000 instead of 4. I got up and left the room. I was so happy just to be invited back to training camp. But that's the kind of guy he was. He would build you up, but never to the point too high where you thought you could tell him what to do. He was still the master, and you were the slaves." "I'm scared," Lombardi said on the first day of training camp in July 1961. Coaches are notorious worrywarts, constantly underrating their squad and inflating the opposition. But in this case, his apprehension was more informed. During his first two seasons in Green Bay, Lombardi had been concerned about the team's talent and whether it knew how to win. Now his fear was different, a fear not to lose. The will to win became not just a positive goal, but a neurosis, an obsessive hatred of losing. The Packers hadn't won it all. They'd not established the winning tradition of the New York Yankees, his sporting model, yet they were being portrayed as sure winners. On the schedule of every other team in the league, he said there would be a circle around the date of their game against Green Bay. Lombardi carried this dread with him to St. Norbert that summer. In an effort to overcome it, he took nothing for granted. He began a tradition of starting from scratch, assuming that the players were blank slates who carried over no knowledge from the year before. He reviewed the fundamentals of blocking and tackling, the basic plays, how to study the playbook. He began with the most elemental statement of all. "Gentlemen," he said, holding a pigskin in his right hand, "this is a football." To which Max McGee, from the rear of the squad, delivered the immortal retort. Coach, could you slow down a little? You're going too fast for us." McGee's line had even Lombardi chuckling, but not for long. He seemed more intense than ever at the daily workouts. "This guy was full of piss and vinegar from the first day of camp," remembered Willie Wood. "I mean, he was hot. You had to work your tail off. He took no nonsense from anybody. He knew that he had a big challenge, and he was determined not to lose again." Lombardi was right, of course. The other teams were gunning for the Packers, making winning more difficult than before. The coach who never wanted to lose drove his team through an undefeated preseason, then lost the season opener to the Lions in Milwaukee. There were two major changes in the starting lineup. Ron Kramer took over for the veteran Gary Kanafel at tight end. It wasn't that Kanafel played only offense, as Lombardi had complained during negotiations, but that Kramer was bigger and a ferocious blocker who could add another dimension to the offense. And Willie Wood replaced M. Tunnell at free safety. In his final year, Tunnell had taught Wood the lessons learned during a long career. "I used to sit around and quiz M all the time. What do you do in this situation? How do you know when your man's coming inside? He taught me how to anticipate what would happen," Wood said later. "M was a very bright guy who helped me tremendously. He'd been around so long, one of the first black stars in the league, and for me, just to have the opportunity to hang around him, I was awed by that. M was so cool." Wood looked rather cool himself back at free safety, though he was anything but relaxed in the locker room beforehand. His pre-game routine was to sit alone at his cubicle, chewing worriedly on a fresh white towel, then another one, before he traipsed over to the bathroom and threw up. But once he took the field, he was all intuition and grace. Number 24 in green and gold, closing ground in a sudden burst to knock away a pass or upend a runner with his unorthodox tackle, flinging his body at the ball carrier's ankles, cutting the feet out from under him so that he flipped wildly into the air, cleats over helmet. It looked effortless, but no one could tackle low like Willie Wood. He and Herb Adderley, a fleet rookie from Michigan State, brought another weapon to the Packers that year, the threat of returning any punt or kickoff for a touchdown. In the first game after the disquieting loss to the Lions, it was Wood's score on a punt runback that led the Packers to a 30-10 win over the 49ers, restoring the hint of a smile to Lombardi's face. The Mythmakers were finding their way to Green Bay, and none of the coach's fears about losing could stop them. The first to arrive that autumn was Tim Cohane. Ever since his days as Fordham's publicity man, Cohane had been Lombardi's great mentioner, praising his talent in almost any discussion of football coaches. Lombardi's success could be traced back to his old college promoter, in a sense. It was Cohane who had persuaded Colonel Blake to hire Lombardi as an assistant at West Point, and it was Blake who then shaped Lombardi's coaching persona. As sports editor of Look, Cohane decided that now was the time to write a piece about Lombardi and the rise of professional football. He reached Green Bay during the week of practice for the third game of the season against the Bears and settled into the guest bedroom at Sunset Circle, bringing with him a parcel of books and opinions which he shared freely in his booming voice, lighting up the house. In their discussions, Lombardi presented a case as to why the pros play better football to Cohane, who dutifully recorded it. There was no nostalgia in the coach's perspective. He said that football had improved so much since his days at Fordham that today I couldn't even make the team. The pro game, he said, had improved most of